Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Garrett Broad, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Rowan University, and I'm very happy to be your host for this conversation with José Tenorio, Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the Institute of Anthropological Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. José is the author of School Food Politics in Mexico: The Corporatization of Obesity and Healthy Eating Policies. For decades now, we've all heard the refrain, "We are in a war against obesity," with perhaps the most important battle being fought over the health of our children. What better place, then, could there be to defeat the enemy of obesity than our schools, where children are fed and educated about being fed on a daily basis? But how did we come to see health promotion in schools as the key solution to solving the problem of obesity? And is obesity really at the root of our problems to begin with? These questions are skillfully explored in School Food Politics in Mexico, which blends policy analysis and ethnographic methods en route to challenging the idea that schools are indeed the ideal place to promote healthy lifestyles. José Tenorio, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks you for having me here, Garrett.
All right. So to get us started, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your professional background?
Yeah, sure. Well, as some of our listeners may guess from my accent, I'm Mexican. So mm-hmm. I was born and raised in a small city in the state of Puebla called Tehuacán. And I lived there through my youth. And then I moved to another state in Mexico called Veracruz. And I lived and studied and worked there for about 10 years. And in 2009, I started working as a teacher in a small rural primary school in the south of Mexico. So I was trained as a teacher. And I went to work in this school. And it was there where I started to get interested in school food, you know, as I was observing in the day-to-day interactions in the school, the politics around food and how kids were fed and all these. And this gave me the idea to do this research project, which was then my PhD, about the intersection between obesity policies and school food and how different discourses are shaping what children eat in schools and why. So I did my PhD at the University of Queensland in Australia. I moved there in 2015. I finished my PhD by 2021, and then I worked within the School of Human Movement and Nutrition Sciences as an associate lecturer for about 2 years until I finished my job there in July 2023, and in February this year I started a new position as a postdoctoral research fellow at the University at UNAM in the Institute of Anthropological Research. So that's a little bit about me, and the book that we'll discuss today was conceived, researched, and written within this PhD framework, and then the 2 years that I was working at the University of Queensland.
Got it. And so when you talk about writing this book, in the book itself, you use cooking as a metaphor to explain how it was developed. So how was working on this book like cooking, and what types of research did you conduct? What were the conversations that you were trying to be a part of as you were creating and developing this recipe?
Yeah, thank you for that question. When I was doing the PhD, when I was a PhD student, it was very difficult for me to sort of bring together all these different ideas and all these different discussions that I was trying to put together. The book explores how different policies influence food practices in Mexican public schools and our understandings of the relationship between food and health. And to do this, I needed to collect different sort of data. For example, I engaged with policy documents, I analyzed these documents, but I also went into schools in Mexico and conducted observations and interviewed a wide range of people who have been involved in the development and implementation of these policies in the Mexican context. So all this variety of data and all these different fields that I engaged with in terms of literature and scholarship were quite diverse, right? So when I was a PhD student and I was trying to make sense of all these different ingredients and trying to connect them, so I found in cooking a good metaphor as a way to explain how I was doing my research. And I use cooking mostly because as I was reading my interviews, as I was reading my field notes, I noticed the importance of cooking in all this process. So initially, my goal was to understand how were these obesity policies developed and implemented, but then I noticed that cooking was at the center of all this work, right? Mm-hmm. And it was when I was in the school kitchens, watching these women, these lovely cooks, preparing the food for the kids and all that. It was then when I said, okay, well, we always think, or at least in my understanding, research was this sort of orderly and structured process where we follow one step and then another step and then another step to eventually come with something written, right? So when I started thinking about doing research as cooking, I incorporated this idea of creativity, of messiness, right? This idea of finding my own recipe. To do this research, I read many recipes, but in the end, I needed to create my own recipe. So that's basically how I use this cooking metaphor to bring together different ingredients.
Yeah. And one of the big ingredients is sort of history of Mexico and public health policy in Mexico. You use the term dispositif to refer to the, quote, ensemble of institutions, discourses, objects, and practices that work as a tool of government. And you kind of introduce this as this background that was really important to understand, this dispositif, really important to understand the broader context of obesity and health policy. So can you give us I know it's a huge topic, we could do a whole podcast or many more on sort of the history of and the arc of food and health in contemporary Mexico, but can you just give us a little bit of a taste? You know, what have been some of the big issues? Who have been some of the powerful players, the big voices that have shaped this context in contemporary Mexico?
Yeah, well, I decided to include this history chapter to provide the which is chapter 2 in the book, to provide the reader a broader overview of Mexican politics and how the Mexican government changed within the 20th century. And the reason why I decided to do this is because when I was reading the literature on school food, everything that had been written was mostly from a sort of epidemiological perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea that schools are the best places to implement these anti-obesity policies, but there was a lack of understanding of how policy has been implemented in different eras in Mexico. So and how the changes in government have influenced the way in which policy, and in this case, school food policy, has been implemented in the Mexican context. And that is why I included this history chapter to provide this broad overview, but also to explain how the change in the Mexican political and economic landscape towards the end of the 1980s allowed this emergence of this form of government, which I call this idea of the dispositive of healthy lifestyles. And dispositive sounds like a very strange word. So it's a French term that was coined by Michel Foucault. And basically, this dispositive term has been translated into English into either apparatus or assemblage. The reason why I didn't use either of these terms is because apparatus, it makes reference to a sort of very technical term, and assemblage, which has been widely used, sometimes lack this historical contextualization of how government has been done in different eras, right? So that's why I am using this term, and also because it helped me to bring together different elements, like, for example, the different discourses that were proposed and that started to circulate to govern the health of children in Mexico, but also the material practices that I observed in schools, right? And try to understand how the discursive side of things shape the practices in the everyday life in schools. And to do this, I try to, that's the reason. And the big issues of and powerful voices that have shaped this context are precisely corporations. And that's something that I also do in chapter 2. So I try to trace how corporations were enabled to grow exponentially in Mexico, especially between these years, between 1980 and the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm. And a couple big players in that shift, one, the 20th century dominated by the PRI party, and then, of course, the across the border, the U.S., the power and the influence of the U.S. Could you just say a little bit about how did the PRI set up this late 20th century, early 21st century context? And what about the role of the U.S. in shaping this education and public health dispositif?
Yeah, well, towards the end of the towards the beginning of the 20th century, Mexico was going through a lot of change, right? So there was a revolution which started in 1910, which historians have debated when did the revolution actually ended in Mexico, right? And there are different perspectives. And for the purpose of my book, I consider that the end of the revolution happened when the PRI, the PRI, what used to be before the PRI, this party, I consider that moment to be like the sort of the end of the revolution, because it's a process where the revolution was institutionalized. So one cannot understand Mexican politics and Mexican government today if we don't understand how this party was created, how it developed, and the sort of policy priorities that they established to construct a modern population, to develop a modern nation state, right? So that's the centrality of this party in Mexican history, and also in terms of education and public health. Why? Because it was during these years, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, when education and public health policy had a priority place in terms of shaping this idea of a modern population. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico, it's always been a tense relationship, mm-hmm. as probably many people know. We share borders. We share a lot of... we have a great flux of migrants on both sides, but it's always been a very complicated relationship, right? And in terms of public health, for example, the U.S. has been influencing Mexico in different ways. And one of those ways was in the 1920s, 1930s, when the Rockefeller Foundation, for example, deployed a series of public health campaigns, and also was training doctors and was training in many of Mexico's in public health officials went to the U.S. to train there. So there was this rationale that Mexican public health should look like the U.S. public health system.
But interestingly, school food looks a little bit different in Mexico than it does in the U.S. So I'd imagine most of our listeners are likely unfamiliar with exactly how school food operates there. So can you just give us some insights into what are the dynamics of school food there? What's served? Who prepares it? When? And how is it consumed? At what price? And how are those priorities set in terms of what school food looks like in Mexico?
Yeah, sure. But I think that before talking about school food in schools, I would like to give to our listeners a quick overview of the Mexican education system.
Sure.
The Secretariat of Public Education is the government organization that frames curriculum assessment and policy at the federal level. Each of the 32 states in Mexico have their own state education authority, which responds to the federal authority, but also has a fair bit of autonomy at the same time. In Mexico, there are nearly 100,000 primary schools, both public and private. And in the state of Veracruz, which is the place where I conducted my fieldwork, has the largest number of primary schools in the country, with a little bit more than 9,000 primary schools there. And in terms of food, food is usually consumed in Mexican schools between 10 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. during a 30-minute break. And if I could use two words to describe school food in primary schools in Mexico, they would be diversely complex. Like, there is, for example, in Mexico, we don't have a national school lunch program or anything similar. There are some specific government programs that provide resources to some schools across the country to feed children, but there's nothing like a national school food program, right? So how does food come into schools is very different depending on the context, and I don't know what happens in the entire country, so I have more idea about what's going on in the state of Veracruz, but I think that this could be similar in other places, right? One of the ways in which food makes its way into schools is by having a kitchen set up in the school. And when I say a kitchen, I would like to ask our listeners to imagine that we are in the Mexican context, right? So many times it's an improvised kitchen where a group of women cook the food for the kids. Another way in which food comes into schools is, for example, through mothers who are asked to prepare food at home and then come into the schools and sell the food, right? And another way is the children themselves bring their lunch boxes, which is also very common. And also, it's very common in many schools that you will find lots of different types of foods, ranging from traditional sort of corn-based foods to a wide range of ultra-processed foods that are available inside these places.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And so despite that diverse complexity, as you put it, one of the things that was kind of unified, it sounds like, across Mexico, or at least in the state of Veracruz, where you were focusing on, is this kind of call to action, this call for a fight against obesity in Mexico and in schools in particular. You're not a fan of that framing of this idea of the fight against obesity. So I'd love to hear about that. What has the fight against obesity looked like in Mexico and its education system? And what's the problem with that language of the fight against obesity?
Yeah, one of the problems that I see with that language, first of all, is that, and this is my reading of policy documents from Mexico, but also other documents from other countries and international organizations, for example, like the World Health Organizations or other organizations in the US. And this language comes from the international landscape, right? So in Mexico, there was probably the mid 2006, 2005, it was then when this idea of a fight against obesity started to circulate in the public debate. And the reason why I am not a fan of this language is because it helps to transfer the responsibility of a structural problem such as obesity into the hands of the individual, right? And also from this idea of fight against obesity, schools are positioned in some ways as the weapons to be used in this fight, right? And with this idea also comes these constructions that present schools as well-resourced spaces, as spaces that have the willingness and that have the time to engage in this fight, right? Which from my experiences, both professional and research experiences, is not true. Schools are, and teachers are very busy doing a hundred of other things, and anti-obesity work or school food stuff is usually a very low priority for them. So, and also because I think that this war against obesity narrative, it's problematic because of the way in which it also positions individuals as responsible for their own health.
Right. And as a big part of that, you critique what you call the discourse of saludable. And I hope my pronunciation is close enough there. It's, my Spanish is rusty. But what was this discourse of saludable? What does that mean? What does that framing emphasize or de-emphasize? How does that connect to your broader critique?
Yeah, well, my English is also a little bit rusty.
Oh,
so I haven't
great.
Spoken English for about six months.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. You're doing
so
wonderful.
Here I am. Well, in Spanish, there are two translations or two words that can be used to translate the English word healthy. Hmm. One of them is sano in the masculine or sana in the feminine. And the other word is saludable. So when I was reading my interviews, transcripts, and when I was looking at my field notes, I noticed that these, in Spanish, we commonly use these words interchangeably, right? So when we refer to food, sometimes we say that the food is sana or that the food is saludable, right? But when I was reading my interview transcripts and my field notes, I noticed that these saludable language was mostly used by the people that I interviewed in Mexico City. So researchers, policymakers, activists, and also people from corporations, people working for corporations, right? And also in government reports, in corporate reports, I saw an emphasis on this word saludable. And it was surprising to me to see that in our casual conversations in the schools with teachers, with cooks, with children, with their parents, they barely use this word. Huh. The only time when they use this word was when I pronounce it first, right? So right. It was myself as a researcher who brought this idea, this language into schools. So when people in schools talk about food, they talk about flavors, they talk about colors, they talk about prices, they talk about the difficulties they had to prepare food, to buy food and all those sort of things, but they barely used this idea of saludable. So that's what I started to frame this word of saludable as a dispositive, right? So as a construction, as a discourse that has been constructed by different institutions and for particular purposes, and that is working to govern the health and food practices of the population through schools.
Yeah, and a big player, as you note, were corporations in constructing that discourse. And this was, you know, through these public-private partnerships that you explore. And you note that these partnerships are, quote, not intrinsically bad, but they can be dangerous, you say. So who were the big corporate players in this conversation? How did they shape public discourse and public policy? And why is that dangerous? In what ways did you see it become dangerous?
Well, transnational food and drink corporations such as Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Nestle, and Bimbo have had a great deal of influence over obesity policy in Mexico and also the school food policy and the promotion of this idea of healthy eating, right? So these corporations have been heavily invested from 2006, when this idea, this narrative of the war against obesity started to circulate. They said, okay, obesity is a problem. Mexicans are getting fatter because they eat too much and because they don't exercise enough. So they propose and push this idea or this discourse of the energy balance, right? Mm-hmm. That people need to be educated to eat healthy and to be physically active. And this is something that I do in chapter 3, by the end of chapter 3, and it's also something that I do in chapter 4. I show how corporations, in chapter 3, I show how corporations shape the language of policy. And I do this by looking at different reports that were written by corporations and also by different memorandums and letters that these corporations or their lobby organizations sent to the Congress or to other entities that were shaping these school food politics in Mexico. And in chapter 2, what I do is I take one of these, and these corporations have created dozens of programs to promote healthy eating in schools and to teach kids to be physically active. And what I do in chapter 4 of the book is to take one of these programs, one that was created by Nestle, and that in partnership with the Secretariat of Education in Veracruz was implemented in many schools in the state. And the reason for doing that is because I wanted to know how it was operating and the how it was operating in the day-to-day in the schools.
Right. I really like this section. You followed a particular set of programs backed by the Nestle Corporation. So what did you get from that on-the-ground observation and the interviewing as well of folks involved in that project? What did you learn about their messages, about their target audiences, about their metrics, about the financial dynamics of anti-obesity programs? How did that field work as part of your broader cooking exploration here? How did that field work, looking at the on the groundwork of Nestle, bring insights that maybe didn't come from the policy analysis alone?
There's a lot of discussion, or when I was doing this research, this field work, I found that there was a lot of discussion in the literature about how corporations were discursively framing health policy or obesity policy, and how they were using this discourse of public or this idea of public-private partnerships, and how they were proposing these partnerships as a sort of panacea for obesity, right? And so I took Nestle as my case study because Nestle has a corporate philanthropic strategy called Creating Shared Value, which basically they say seeks to benefit every person who is part of Nestle's value chain. And one of the components of this Creating Shared Value strategy is Healthy Kids, a global program that Nestle launched in 2006 to teach children how to have a healthy diet and why and how important it is to have a healthy diet, right? And this program was implemented from 2010, 2011, 2013 in the state of Veracruz. And indeed, it was the only place in Mexico where this program was successful. So I was very interested in this and in knowing more, a little bit more about the dynamics of this program and how it worked. So during my time in schools, I was asking to the teachers, how was this program? How did they work with it? And also I interviewed the staff members who were in charge of this program. And in Veracruz, the Mexican version of this program, Healthy Kids, basically was about promoting healthy eating through embedding this content in the curriculum, but also through and also a very important difference or something that it's very important to highlight here is that Nestlé chose this state of Veracruz to implement this program because Veracruz is fundamental for Nestlé's operations in Mexico. Why? Yeah. One of its biggest coffee factories in the world is there. Veracruz is a coffee producer state. They also produce sugar. They produce milk. So it's a very important place for Nestlé, right? And also another point that it's important to mention is that there was already a lot of health promotion work going on in this place. And this health promotion was mostly conducted or done by staff within the Secretariat of Education in Veracruz, right? So when Nestlé and the Secretariat of Education decided to collaborate together to implement and reach more schools with this program, the main change was that with the previous government-led program, there was no accountability for teachers, right? For example, teachers could choose to implement that program or not, but when Nestlé partnered with the Secretariat of Education, this program became compulsory, and teachers needed to create reports, write reports, collect evidence, take pictures, and of course, upload these to a platform that was set up by Nestlé. And well, I think that there is like all this data that was collected by public servants, teachers, and transferred to Nestlé's hands for their own use, right? And one of the problematics that I see with this program, Nestlé's program, is that even though this corporation says that this is an unbranded program, so that they are not trying to advertise any of their products or anything like that, everyone, teachers, parents, they all knew this as the Nestlé's program, right? Mm. So there was a sort of branding position in all this stuff going on there.
And you also said just now that it was sort of considered a success. But by what metrics was it a success? And did you see it as a success based on the feedback you were getting on the ground?
Well, this idea of this program being a success is something that it's widely publicized by Nestlé, right? So if, for example, you jump onto Nestlé's website, you will see and you look for this Healthy Kids program. You will see there lots of statistics, for example, saying because Nestlé has implemented these Healthy Kids program in different countries around the world. So what you will see in their website is are statistics saying that 1 million schools around the world have been trained in healthy eating, that there are 10,000 million of kids who are healthier now because of this program and all that, right? So to me, this was very different from my observations on the ground. Teachers liked the program. I have to say that. They liked it. They liked that it was connected with the curriculum. So, and because there was a lot of work, because Nestlé Mexico poured a lot of resources so that this staff within the Secretariat of Education could implement these and work with the teachers and how to implement this program, right? So teachers do like it. Because it was a good program, But they were also conscious about this idea that, well, it's a sort of flat position in their brand. And also they always said that, well, it was a very short period of time where we were like given materials, and the materials were only a few cookbooks and a few cards to promote healthy eating and things like that. So, but they said like, well, the program was only here with us for 1 year, and that's it. And after that, it was all on us without that follow-up from someone else helping us to implement this, right? And also, I was very curious about asking the kids like about their nutritional skills, their nutritional knowledge, all that. And when I was during this break time talking to the kids while they were eating, I tried to be careful in terms of not giving or putting a particular adjective on food myself, right? So I wanted to hear their voices. And I usually ask kids, like, what are you eating? I'm eating this, I'm eating a sandwich, I'm eating a quesadilla, I'm eating an empanada. And I used to ask, like, what do you prefer? Well, I prefer this. And what do you think is better for you? And they said, for example, in terms of drinks, like they said, like, well, I know that drinking water is the best, but I love Coca-Cola and I love sweetened beverages because they are great, right? So is this disconnection between what is supposed to be a very sort of successful story, that when we look at things that happened in the ground, the story is different, right?
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Ooh. And anger. Ah! Definitely some disgust.
Gross.
And I think a little fear.
Ah! Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Yeah, that's a big theme of especially the sort of second half of your book, when you get more into the ethnographic fieldwork, that, you know, food policy, school food policy happens at that policy level, but it takes place day to day in the schools. You write that, quote, the everyday working of healthy lifestyles in schools has been largely overlooked. So you have these two different schools that are primary sites for your field work. You just talked a little bit about some of the insights you got from students there, but what did these schools, sort of share? How did they differ in terms of their food practices? What did you learn from this comparison between these two schools?
Yeah, well, before I mentioned that when I was reviewing the literature of school food and in Mexico and internationally, there are a few books out there who have approached school food from a more sort of sociological or historical right. perspective. But most of the literature focuses on assessing the effectiveness of interventions and assessing how the relationship between school food programs, for example, and academic achievement and all those things, right? So what I wanted to do was, and because also in connection with my background as a teacher, I knew that there's a big disconnection between what is written in policy and what happens in the everyday life in schools. So with these two ideas in mind, so the lack of a more sort of sociological approach to school food in schools and this disconnection between policy and practice, I decided to go into two schools and spend a few months there observing what children ate in schools and why. And for this reason, I selected a rural school and an urban school, both located in the central region of the state of Veracruz. And as I said, I spent there a few months talking to the cooks talking to the teachers, talking to the children and their parents. And both schools were obviously different. One school, the urban school, was a very big school for the Mexican standards, more than or nearly 1,000 schools, which it's very big for a primary school in the state of Veracruz. And the other, the rural school, was a very small, no more than 150 students enrolled, and the communities were different, right? So the rural school was located in a very marginalized, a small town, a region where sugar cane is the main industry, and most of the parents of the kids attending the school worked in the sugarcane industry. So that all that gave the production of food in the school a particular characteristics. And the same happened in the urban school, right? So it was a big school. It was also situated in a sort of low socioeconomic area in the metropolitan region of Veracruz. And the main difference was about how food was offered in the school and the sort of products that were offered in the school. In the urban school, it was common to find handmade food, like traditional sort of handmade food, but also a lot of other ultra-processed foods. Whereas in the small school, the rural school, there was a group of women who were in charge of cooking the breakfast for the kids every day, right? And this was the result of an internal organization of the school and negotiations with the community about how to better feed the kids in the school. But also, beyond the differences between these two places, one of the main similarity is that in both schools, there were a group of women who worked very hard under very difficult conditions to produce handmade foods for the kids, right? And also another difference was the price. Like in the urban school, the prices for the food was more expensive, and whereas in the other place, it was easier for the students to access the food. And even they could get the food in the school, even if they didn't pay for the meal, which was very difficult for the school finances as well.
Yeah, I thought it was so interesting in that discussion, the place of masa-based foods and how that kind of represented this tension between local food cultures, between what the women working in these kitchens were producing and why, and what these kind of broader policy discourses of saludable were saying was healthy. So could you tell us, how does masa tell us something about the tensions, the disconnects between the policy and the everyday work and life?
Absolutely. Well, as our audience probably know, corn is central to the diets and identities of people in Mexico. Corn is consumed in Mexico in multiple forms, right? We could spend a whole hour here and we wouldn't finish listing all the different meals and drinks that are made out of corn and enjoyed widely in Mexico. Masa is the Spanish word for corn dough. And different types of masa-based foods are prepared and consumed in different regions in the country. In the state of Veracruz, the most common masa-based foods are empanadas, which are deep-fried pockets of masa stuffed with cheese. Also, another very common masa-based food are picadas, which are small tortillas with a leaf form around the edge, topped with beans, green, or red salsa. And I'm saying all these examples of masa-based foods because it's important. And it's important because the ingredients that are needed to make masa-based foods are commonly available in the communities, and they are relatively cheaper in comparison with other ingredients that are needed to prepare other sort of foods. And so in the state of Veracruz, the consumption of masa-based foods is very common, as is in other places around Mexico. But from probably when these healthy eating programs from Nestle and when other government policies came into these schools to promote or to change the diets of kids in the name of fighting obesity. Some of these products started to be, what's the word?
Pushed out or marginalized, yes.
It started to be stigmatized. That's the word. It started to be stigmatized as to be unhealthy,
right.
Mostly because they have some fats and because they are deep fried and all that. So they started to be stigmatized. And what some people in the schools, for example, in the rural school, the cooks, they told me that after 2012, 2013, they started to serve masa-based foods, or they started trying to serve masa-based foods no more than 3 days a week, based on the nutritional recommendations that they were given. And they tried really hard, and the other 2 days, they tried to cook something else, a more sort of elaborated dish, an elaborated meal. However, in practice, this was very difficult. Why? Because of the economics of the ingredients,
right?
And also because of the preferences of the kids. Yeah. When I was in the schools, I many times observed, for example, that the kids were offered spaghetti. They didn't like it. The bean was full of spaghetti, right? And when the kids were served empanadas, for example, they loved it. They could have the 4 or 5 empanadas. They were very happy eating this food. So what I'm trying to do in the book, when I show and discuss how these women cook these meals, is precisely to emphasize something that is not commonly emphasized in the discussion of school food, which is the labor that goes into producing real food, as opposed to other types of products that are easily available, such as ultra-processed foods, right? So, and that's something that I wanted to do that chapter in highlighting both the tensions between the discourse, the saludable discourse, but also this cooking of real food by real women.
Yeah, there's another interesting story on a somewhat similar tack around the discussion of sugar-sweetened soda, refrescos, as they're referred to there, and the rise of bottled water. And you make this kind of interesting point. You say that, you know, water is obviously healthier than refrescos, but you write that, quote, the fact that Mexicans are buying more bottled water does not necessarily mean that they're healthier. So can you tell us a little bit about that story of the rise of bottled water and what is, you know, why is it not necessarily making them healthier in Mexico or in Mexican schools if they're shifting away from sugar-sweetened refrescos?
Yeah, well, talking about this can put me into dangerous terrain, right? So I want to clarify that I do believe that drinking water is better than drinking any other sort of sugar sweetened soda, right?
Sure.
So that's the first clarification that I would like to make. My point about the fact that drinking and buying more bottled water doesn't necessarily mean that people are healthier in Mexico or children are healthier in Mexico. It's precisely because of the commodification process that has come with this idea and all this promotion that we need to drink 8 glasses of water per day or 2 liters of water per day. And when this advice is given in a context, in a country like Mexico, I don't know if our listeners have been to Mexico, but if they have, I'm sure that they have been probably surprised with the fact that we always have to pay for the water that we drink. It may be the same case in other countries. And this is something that struck me when I came back from Australia. So I was living in Australia, and when I came back to do my fieldwork in Mexico, it was one of the things that annoyed me the more, right? The fact that I had to pay for water. While in Australia, I could get my water for free everywhere in these water fountains and all that. So it was,
you mean even coming out of the tap, that's getting kind of metered and you're getting charged.
Exactly. Whereas in Mexico, drinking water from the tap is impossible. And in the 6th chapter of the book, I provide a little bit of historical background about why Mexicans don't drink tap water, right? And how this, in combination with the circulation of this discourse, this idea that we need to drink more water and that water, drinking water is healthier, how all this has ended to the commodification of water. And also, Mexico is among the top consumers of sweetened, sugar sweetened sodas or refrescos, how we call it in Mexico, and in special of Coca-Cola. I was surprised, and this is something that I knew from my teaching experiences, and then I corroborated it again when I was doing the research in the schools. I was surprised to hear kids, 8-year-old kids, 10-year-old kids saying, I love Coca-Cola. If I could drink Coca-Cola all day, I would do it, right? Mm-hmm. And ironically, these bottles of water which are available in schools are mostly made their way there by, or they are delivered by Coca-Cola as well, right? So it's like changing one product for another product, right? Mm-hmm. And in schools, these days, in Mexican schools, and this is, I think, one of the main contributions of some policies, government policies, the consumption of these refrescos in schools have decreased significantly, and now there's more water. But this water is sold mostly by Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, in some cases by Nestle.
Right. So hasn't led to kind of fixing the water infrastructure in a way that would make, you know,
No. And also in 2013, there was a tax, a sugar tax, it's called,
right,
that was passed in Mexican Congress. So I think that this received a lot of attention, right, around the world, the fact that Mexico put a tax on soda. And it's a huge achievement, of course. But one of the main arguments given by some people about why this tax was important, one of the main arguments given was that this tax, that the money from this tax was or could be used to fund is fountains, water fountains in schools so that kids could access free, clean water. This never happened. There was a program that was set up for this purpose, but the money, as it's common in Mexico, never reached the schools.
Yeah, wow. So that kind of leads us to the last big point here, which is really your key conclusion in all of this, was that, you know, in this quote-unquote fight against obesity in Mexico, schools were positioned as the ideal space to fight it through healthy eating promotion, through food regulations. But you argue that's really not the case, in large part because schools are not closed off from the rest of the society, right? That they're connected through, you know, these various entanglements to the state, to corporations, to the experiences of school staff, to the experiences of families. And so you really make this case that we shouldn't think of schools as separated, right? But rather they're kind of porous spaces that connect them. So what do we gain when we think of schools as embedded within these broader dispositifs, to go back to your original term? What do we gain from understanding schools as embedded within that? And then, of course, from there, what do we do? What could we do differently? If you were, you know, kind of in charge of school food policy in Mexico, what would you be putting into practice?
One of the reasons I wrote this book was to offer another side of the story about school food in Mexico and the relationship between school food and health. As I've mentioned today, the dominant narrative about school food and why regulating school food is important in the context of the fight against obesity, the dominant narrative depicts schools as obesogenic environments where children eat as much food as they want. And also this narrative, as I said before, constructs schools as well-resourced and bounded spaces that have the time and willingness to improve food to contribute to the fight against obesity. So I wanted to challenge this idea and said, look, yes, schools may be a good place to promote health, and this has happened historically, right? But it's dangerous to think that schools and education, it's going to solve a structural problem, right? So the diet of Mexican people was changed by changes in economic and political in economic policy and the political landscape in Mexico, right? So there's an important connection, and this is something that I also document widely in the book, between the economic transformation of Mexico and NAFTA and all that, and the diets of Mexicans, and therefore the negative effects on the health of Mexico, right? So I wanted to offer this other perspective of saying, well, look, schools are busy doing other stuff, cooking. The preparation of food happens under very difficult circumstances. There are many points, very important points that aren't considered in policies, such as, for example, labor and the time that is required to prepare food and the resources that are needed and all that. And that is precisely why I offer these from the ground, everyday perspective on school food. And this idea that schools are not closed spaces, but porous spaces where different discourses and practices move inwards and outwards, I think that it's very important to create a more sort of culturally sensitive policy, right? And by this, I mean that we, and many times my reading of the policies in Mexico in the school food space, and in the obesity space, it's very evident that they have a lot of influence from other countries, right? And it's many times I could see as these policies as to be a literal translation of policies, for example, in the US. And I think that the reality, the social conditions in Mexican schools in the US or other countries are very different, right? So I think that we need to pay more attention to the real conditions under which food is produced in schools, and only acknowledging all these differences is that there may be better policies. And in terms of what would I propose, I mean, that's difficult to say, because I can say a lot of good things, right? But this is something that I discussed towards the end of the conclusions in the book, that under the current policy environment, Mexico, which is shaped or framed by a center to the left government, I think that there are the conditions to create and implement a national school lunch program, or that could be a possibility, right? And also I want to say that Mexico last week, 2 weeks ago, a new food law was just approved. And I think that this new law opens the space to a different sort of school's food policy, right? Why? Because, for example, in this document, the schools are situated, especially in terms of this, you know, broader social network and how they can be connected to, for example, local food producers, and how the government and the role of the state is quite important and is highlighted again in these policies, in this law, something that wasn't necessarily done in previous policies, right? Where the main intention was to reduce government and sort of transfer the responsibility of solving this issue into people's hands.
Right. Yeah. Well, Jose, it's been really a fascinating exploration here, both reading the book and having this conversation today. So I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us. I just want to finish up with our traditional New Books Network final question, which is, what are you working on? What are you thinking about these days?
I started, as I mentioned at the beginning, I started a postdoctoral fellowship at the Institute of Anthropological Research at UNAM in February this year. And the project that I'm working on is about the consumption of ultra-processed foods in Chiapas. So from the research that I was doing on school food, there was a lot of, there were lots of ideas about, you know, this idea of the consumption of ultra-processed foods as a sign of modernity, as a sign of being modern, right? When you consume, when you drink Coca-Cola, you are a sort of a modern person. And if you drink something else, you are not modern, right? So based on these ideas that were emerging during my previous research, I wrote this research proposal to explore from a historical and cultural perspective the consumption of ultra-processed foods in Chiapas. And why Chiapas? Well, Chiapas is a very interesting state, very complex politics there. But also, I think that it's a place where we can learn a lot about ways of resisting dietary change as well.
That's
what I'm working on at the moment.
Great. Sounds like another really interesting project that will have relevance, not just for scholars interested in Mexico and across Latin America, but for anybody interested in thinking about what healthy, sustainable food systems look like. Jose Tenorio is the author of School Food Politics in Mexico, the Corporatization of Obesity and Healthy Eating Policies. Thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thanks, Garrett.